there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 382. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have such a fun show for you this week. We don't have a ton of traditions here at This Show Is So Gay over the past 8 years, but one of the ones that we can count on is if it's Christmas time, that means we get Netta Ulaby back on the show. Let me introduce her to you. As if you don't know, Netta Ulaby reports on arts, entertainment, and cultural trends for NPR's Arts Desk. Her stories have included a series on women record producers, an investigation into exhibitions of plastinated human bodies, and a look, she knows it's my favorite story, a look at the legacy of gay activist Harvey Milk. Netta has earned multiple fellowships at the Getty Arts Journalism Program at USC Annenberg, as well as a fellowship at the Knight Center for Specialized Journalism to study youth culture. In addition, Netta's weekly podcast of NPR's Best Art Stories, Culturetopia, won a Gracie Award from the Alliance for Women in Media Foundation. Netta, welcome back to The Show Is So Gay.
Can I just tell you that it is the dream of every little gay boy and girl to have a Christmas special? And I feel like this is as close as I'm ever going to get. It feels so good.
This is our Christmas special. You were first on the show. No joke. It was 8 years ago already.
Amazing. Wow. And why is it that looking at you right now, we both look so young?
It's amazing. It's amazing. I think it's all that watching of Prince Caspian, which is what you were doing the first time.
Was.
The first time.
Oh my gosh, your memory is terrifying. That's exactly right. I think I was actually escaping Prince Caspian.
I was so happy to provide that escapism for you. And here we are, 8 years later.
In our own private Narnia.
Exactly. Wow, that's a metaphor we're going to embrace in our private therapy session later. Good stuff, good stuff. Well, we have so much ground to cover because I will say, you know, like many Christmas specials, we took a year off last year, so we have 2 years to catch up on.
Let's do it.
All right. Well, just remind our listening audience, NPR, just such amazing things happening over there. In the third person, what would you say that Netta Ulaby brings to NPR?
Oh, God, like a jaded perspective, a thoroughly queer sensibility. I think I'm fair that that's fair to say. You know, I often get introduced at NPR events as the sort of house lesbian Jew Arab.
Nice.
So I'm that with, you know, a healthy dose of working class Irish American mixed in. I guess that's what I bring. You know, fallen arches. I don't know what else to say.
I'm actually surprised at NPR that being the queer Jewish Arab separates you from other people.
You know what? When I first got to NPR, I came in literally the same month that another gay half Arab left.
Wow.
And it was like there was a slot. And I was very sad to see him go. I was really excited to work. It was the first time I was going to work with another gay half Arab. And Rob went to Chicago and we have not talked, but yeah, apparently there is a designated slot, and I am so joking. There's a designated slot for the gay half Arab.
Do you keep your eye on his career in case he leaves his next thing? You're like, all right, that's another opening.
I should. That would be my next path. You know, and there are so many opportunities for us. You know, who doesn't want to hire the gay half Arab?
I love it. I love it. That's what our Christmas special is all about.
That's right. just like Bethlehem so many years ago.
It really is. It's a cross between that and the Charlie Brown one. So we're right smack in the middle.
Right.
We're right in the middle.
And Prince Caspian, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
A little Prince Caspian in there, too.
Oh, of course. Of course. That's really the amalgam that we're looking for. Now, I would like to understand a little bit more of how your professional life works. Where do ideas for stories come from?
Well, yeah, you know, with a job like mine, they mostly come from me.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't be doing my job if I wasn't generating ideas. And one of the things I always say to the young up-and-comers, that, you know, you have to give your ideas away. You have to come up with a billion ideas all the time and give them away and give them away and give them away. And if you just have one good idea, then this isn't the place for you to be. And so I come up with most of them. But that said, you know, every so often someone dies, and I'll do their obit. So it's never my idea for someone to die, I assure you.
Yeah.
Although there, we do have an advanced obit shelf, and I really feel like I cannot tell you who's on it. You can probably guess. But I have probably about 20 advanced obits that have been done. And then the shows occasionally ask for pieces. So, for example, I'm just wrapping up a piece right now that a show requested for this weekend that is about toys that represent some kind of disability. And that is the kind of thing that I had given absolutely no thought to before I started working on. I do not have any any visible disability, nor do many people in my life. And I went to a Target and walked around the toy aisle with this incredible disability advocate who's also a little person, and looking at the toys through her eyes, and she's a mom, which I'm not, and just realizing for the first time that one out of every four people is going to have some sort of disability at some point in their lives. And here we are looking at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of toys, and we saw two toys that represented disability.
Wow.
One was Luke Skywalker after he's had his arm chopped off by Darth Vader, and it's got that
prosthetic
on it. So that was one. And the other one was Nemo from the movie Finding Nemo. He has a kind of a shortened little thing on one side. And that was really it. And there are other toys, American Girl and Lego, but, you know, you pretty much, I think, have to order them off websites. You can't just go to a toy store or go to the Target and walk down the aisle and just find these toys. Or at least we didn't when we walked down the aisle of this specific Target. It was very illuminating, and I think when you come from a background as a gay or lesbian or queer or transgender person, and representation is something that's been incredibly meaningful to us over the years, and Ken, you and I are certainly of an age where we went from almost zero representation to, you know, now we're swimming in it. We know how incredibly important it is, and this working on this piece was transformational for me. I was astonished thinking about it. And seriously, like, now all I want to do, all the kids in my life, I'm just going to give them toys that represent disability for Christmas.
Nice. And that's just one identity. I would imagine that if you are living in that intersection of multiple identities of having a disability and being a person of color, you have nothing in the way of toys.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to think, because actually the woman that I walked around with, her, she's Caucasian, but her husband is African-American, and her kids, the way she described them is they are biracial dwarf kids. And how, you know, she's like, I don't see my kids in popular culture. They're not there. And so, and I remember talking to someone years ago for a story who was, what piece was it? But there was, I remember, it was Paris Barclay, who's gay.
Yeah.
And who's a big showrunner, big Directors Guild of America. He's the first African-American, I could be getting this wrong, but he was at least one of the first African-American heads of the Directors Guild of America, tons of TV shows. And he was doing something with some character who was African-American and had a disability, and people were fighting him on this because they were basically saying, oh, how can this character be both black and disabled? That's too much. That's too much.
We couldn't possibly stomach that. That's just, right? We can't handle that.
Right.
Oh my.
So he is. You should call him sometime for your show, because that is a guy who has really been fighting the good fight.
You always give me good suggestions. I think I told you. You recommended Sonari Glinton and Zoe Chace, and I don't think I got a word in when the two of them were on the show together. It was like a whole variety show. It was amazing.
Yeah, the two of them, they're not exactly wallflowers.
I love it. Now, I have to say, for those of us who are fortunate enough to be friends with you on Facebook, you put these posts out there occasionally that sometimes I'm thinking, is she punking us? I don't know exactly what's happening, where you do a call for experts at some, sometimes it feels maybe very obscure places of intersectionality, and I don't have any here, but I was thinking they're always kind of like, does anybody know anybody who knows something about anime that also features grapefruits? Like, it's just something very specific. Does anybody know an expert on tap dancing as it applies to British Parliament? I'm like,
let me write that down. That's a good one.
But I love that. I and You have never put something, this is my impression, I could be wrong. I feel like you have never put something up there where you've called for an expert without someone saying, oh yeah, no, I know exactly who you should talk to.
Right? Well, this is the glory of the internet, which I sometimes otherwise feel should just be completely shut down. Right, you know?
It allows you to connect with these people who are doing these, and everybody's passionate.
Oh, they come out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
Of course. And I do have to say, and I don't want to be super negative, but I'll be a little negative.
Go for it.
Someone will be like, oh, yeah, I know exactly the right person. And it'll turn out to be like Cousin Joe, who like once saw a tap dancing movie, you know? So, you know, yes. But the moral is that people want to help. As Mr. Rogers says, you look for the helpers. And, you know, and they're there. Whether how helpful they are is another question.
Every time you put one of those posts up there, I am determined to be one of those people, and I've never come even close. You will put up there, does someone know a person? And that's about as close as I can get to it. And then you add more specifics, and I've never been an expert in something you've been looking for.
Well, because I am inordinately fond of you, Ken. You might just have to expect a tailor-made call for help one of these days. Does anybody know a gay Jew who travels?
There you go.
In Ohio.
On my because street, I could, that's about as specific as it'll get.
And are you right-handed or left-handed?
Oh, it's such good stuff. Well, I've done what I would call the Ullaby immersion. I do it every year where I go back through your stories and find the gayest stories that you've done in the past year.
Ooh,
and so okay. I'm excited to talk about it. Although, I don't know if this first one is a gay story, but we have to talk about the fact that almost a year ago, I think it's about a year ago next week, you had quite the debate with an editor of yours about whether or not Santa is an elf.
Correct. And it was a really weird debate, you know, for two people who really don't care about Christmas very much to have.
And where did you come down on that?
I was pro-elf. My editor, Rose Friedman, was anti-elf.
Okay.
And it was quite ferocious. My editor, Rose, she's one of several editors I have, but absolutely one of my favorites, is ridiculously young. She's still in her 20s. Ridiculously bright and super duper careful about things. And this was actually a piece I was doing about how American Muslims observe Christmas or not, what they do on Christmas. And the whole sort of idea was, we all know what a Jewish Christmas is, right?
Yeah.
What is it?
That would be Chinese food and a Broadway show for my family.
Or movies, right?
Yeah.
And so what do Muslims do on Christmas? So that was sort of the conceit of the piece. And somehow, I talked to these two, I don't know if you heard that piece, but I talked to two of the most charming lesbian Muslim Christmas fans on the planet. Two other people you should actually probably talk to because they were hilarious. But I talked to also these women who run a podcast called Good Muslim, Bad Muslim. And one of them was telling the story about how she came from Iran when she was a little girl. And she goes to kindergarten, and the kids are talking about Santa, and she has no idea what Santa is because she's just moved from the People's Theocratic Republic of Iran. And she's like, who's Santa? And they say, well, he's a kindly old man with a beard who loves children. And she says, back in Iran, I used to read these textbooks that showed the Ayatollah Khomeini like giving presents to children. That must be Santa. So she goes home and she's like, Dad, Mom, this is amazing. All the kids in kindergarten know exactly who the Ayatollah Khomeini is, but they call him Santa. And then, as I say in my script, leaving her parents to explain that the supreme leader of the People's Theocratic Republic of Iran is not a kindly European slave-driving elf from literature. And my editor says he's not an elf. And I say, he is an elf. She says, he's not an elf. I say, he is an elf. And that's the kind of intellectual discussions we have at NPR sometimes. It went on for quite a while. And I pulled out my literature and my references, the poem, the big poem that calls him an elf. She threw out something else. We called in other people. It became quite the exchange. And at some point, someone from All Things Considered was like, you actually should maybe just bring this on to the radio. And so it became its own separate story.
I love that in other circumstances, this actually was Saturday Night Live spoof on Serial, but it was a real story for you.
It's That was so funny. I did, for the record, I did change my language in the story because I always obey my editors. I said, I don't remember what I said, something like a mythical figure from Northern European folklore. I did not call Santa an elf, but he's an elf.
There you go.
He's
an elf. No, your editor's not on the show right now. You get the last word.
She's wrong. This time.
I love it. Oh, okay. All right, let's dive into some of these stories. Can I just say, you tell me if I'm wrong, I feel like when I started this bit years ago, there were less gay-tinged stories. So either I'm seeing the gay in more stories, or you're bringing it forward, and I don't know which it is.
I think it's you.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I think you were maybe a little more repressed 8 years ago, and you know, you just weren't comfortable with yourself. And can I salute you? I salute you for really becoming more comfortable.
I think episode 383 is the one where I come out. I think that's the one. It's not this week, but...
It was somewhere around there when, you know, I really felt you coming into your own as a gay man.
Yeah, until this point, I've just been an ally, but I think I'm almost ready. I'm almost ready. All right, let's talk about some of these stories. You had a wonderful story on the evolution of the Barbie ad, which I actually played for my students when we were talking about gender in class.
Moschino Barbie.
Exactly. Talk to us about where that idea came from.
That one was not my idea. I don't remember who pitched it to me. But that was, and it's only a gay story insofar as that it is A, about Barbie.
Yeah.
And B, for the first time, there was an ad featuring a boy playing with Barbie along with his two young lady friends. They're all, you know, probably about 6 or 7, and in which he describes Barbie as fierce. And I know that's... We got to do some serious reading between the lines on this one, right? But you know, it's very clear that this is an ad celebrating a diversity of gender expressions and not putting down hard and fast rules about who gets to play with what and who gets to enjoy their Barbie play. It was a pretty cool ad, and it was not, by the way, unnoticed that the little boy in the ad looks a lot like the designer who is tasked with designing this particular Barbie. But that was just kind of a jumping off point to go back in time over how Barbie has been represented. It was a little bit of an our Barbie ourselves kind of a piece. And it looked at how Barbie was marketed to Americans in the 1950s and 60s and 70s and 80s. And to now, and it's, you know, it's always fun when you can kind of track something as iconic as Barbie through the ages.
Yeah.
And the very first Barbie ad is all about her getting married. But what's kind of adorable is that there's, at the time, I don't even think there was a Ken doll.
Huh. She was just going through the motions.
Well, she was, it was about her,
yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of us, especially of us who maybe identify more on the femme side of things, always found a kind of relief in the marginality of Ken.
Right.
It was really all about your Barbie and her friends and just dressing her up like crazy. That was the good stuff.
I would like to believe that without Ken there, that first wedding that Barbie was attending as the bride was, she was getting wedded to social justice or to her career. I'm not sure, but I would like to believe that.
Or to just a very handsome butch person.
Right.
Who is sexually ambiguous.
Yes. That's a good one, too. Oh, I'm looking forward to that story
not
coming
to put
out.
Not too fine a point of it. But, you know, Ken kind of opens up a broad array of ways to consider masculinity.
Oh, yeah. Yes, he does.
And I support that.
I support it, too. Again, listeners, we are here with Netta Ulaby from NPR's Arts Desk. Well, there was one story that you did. Let me just tell you this. And listening audience, I might not have talked about him a ton because he likes to keep his name off the show. But my partner, let's call him Richard, he is pretty even-keeled. Very even-keeled, but
that's
one...
Good. That's good in a partner.
It is very good, because it is not replicated in his partner, so it's good. Nice for balance. But I will say that there was one Netta Ulaby story, and it was quite recently, that got him so just smiling, grinning ear to ear, because he's such a fan, and that would be your story on Miranda Sings.
Seriously?
He loves Miranda. He is, as we all know, a Murfanda.
You know, sometimes you do stories that just sort of feel like they they just don't get any traction. Like, I'm going to admit it, and I don't say this to just anyone all the time, but, you know, every so often, you know, I'm enough of a glutton for punishment that I'll occasionally, like, stick my name into Twitter. I want to see if people are talking about the pieces I did, or more likely what I'll do is I'll just, like, put in a few keywords from the headlines. You know, I want to know if people care, because I care.
Yeah.
You know, it's not so much like, are they talking about me? I want to know if they're talking about the story. And and I think Brandis Sings is amazing. And that just didn't seem to be one that got a lot of traction. And the fact that your partner loved it is the best holiday present that
Look
I could
that.
Possibly imagine. Like, my heart just grew 10 times.
Oh, he's going to be so happy
Please
to hear that.
You.
Yeah, no. Oh, I'm actually shocked to hear that, because she's got quite the fan base, and you had a different take on it, just in that you were really featuring it in a very measured, hey, what's this about sort of way, which everyone here on Fir Avenue, we appreciated it here in Cleveland.
I'm embarrassed. Now, this is the one thing I don't like about talking to you, is that I feel like I talk about myself too much. And it's like a weird, I don't know. It's, you know, when I just don't like talking about myself. But how do you think it was different? Wasn't it just like, hey, there's this show with this really oddball, amazing talent, and that's what the show is?
I think in some ways, just because it is such niche marketing. Now, Miranda Sings really it's a very in the know.
No, it just got picked up for a second season.
There it is. So that it might be more press now. But when you covered it, it was, there were a lot of people. I think there are a lot of NPR listeners who have absolutely no idea what Miranda Sings is all about. So I thought you were starting from stage one, and I thought it was great.
That show is so funny, and this is my giant regret about that piece. There was a way to do that piece that would have been so much better, and I didn't have my act together enough to do it the way I should have done it. And the way I should have done it was focusing on faith.
Hmm.
Is your partner from a pretty serious Christian background?
Guess what? My partner this semester just started seminary.
Because I did not realize this when I interviewed Miranda Sings. There's no excuses. I should have done the story differently. And the woman who is Miranda Sings, and again, forgive, I didn't know we'd be talking about it, so I didn't brush up. She comes from a really, really serious and perhaps even fundamentalist Christian background.
She does.
And yes, you know, so you know this. Yeah.
Colleen Ballinger, yeah.
Yes, and she also does the show with her family. You know, she does it with her brother, and there are a lot of ways in which it reflects their background. And and if you watch the show, you know that faith and church is a major, major part of this show. And if I was to do that piece again, it would have been all about that. And when I first watched it, I only saw the first two episodes. I didn't know enough about her background. By the time I was pretty much finished with it, I knew how I should have done it. And I just wish I'd had more time, because I think there's a much more interesting piece to be done about that show right now. Or not just right now, but there would have been a much better way to have done that piece. And that piece really feels like a missed opportunity.
Well, let me just say this, because I feel that you are just as comfortable talking about yourself as you are comfortable receiving compliments.
Just to say not at all.
Exactly. I would say that the fact that you have that critical eye towards it, and you, I'm sure, know there are any number of people who put out pieces who are like, yeah, you know what, I do it the same way next time. And I do think that the fact that you look back at some of these pieces and see a different angle and see a different direction means that you really are always trying to better your craft. So look how that just became a compliment.
Nicely done, Ken. There are a few pieces where I do feel like they did come out pretty well, and I'm proud of them. But like the Muslim piece, for example, the Christmas Muslim piece, I am so proud of that piece.
Nice.
That piece came out so good. But I wish Miranda Sings, it could have been a little deeper, because, you know, as an arts reporter, you don't want to do fluffy entertainment. You want to talk about how this stuff is reflecting us, you know, and I could have done a better job with that one. But again, that said, I'm so honored that you're that your partner liked.
Oh, loved it. Love that piece. Well, I have to ask you that question because arts play a pretty darn important role in our society, and we are not.
So the gays would say.
The gays would say, and we're not going into politics because that's not what we're going to go into right now. But I would also imagine that where you work and a place that covers the news, and you're at a different desk. Are you insulated from all that, or does it affect the stories that you pursue?
We've done a lot of thinking about how best to cover the arts moving forward.
Yeah.
You know, and the wonderful thing about covering arts at NPR, and this was true when I started in 2000, which was during President Bill Clinton, and it didn't change during President Bush, and it didn't change during President Obama, and it's not going to change during President Trump, is that we think of ourselves as political reporters, even though we are arts reporters.
Got it.
We are not fluffy entertainment reporters. We are always looking into the broader implications, the messages, the meanings behind what artists and creators are trying to say, whether they are pop stars or whether they are avant-garde, experimental classical musicians. They are the expressions that people are making about the society that we live in are worthy of thoughtful analysis. And I wish that there were more people who were applying that kind of analysis in the media. And I'm so grateful for the people who are.
Yeah. Oh, it's such good stuff. Good stuff. Another one of my favorite pieces from this past year. Why are there so many tough guys who sound like ladies on the radio?
Not my idea. That was my old editor, Sarah Saracen. That was her idea.
That was a great piece, though, because I think that really got it. Performing masculinity and what is it we even sound like and who do we consider to be male and virile? And that was good stuff, Netta.
Oh, and do you know where the germ of that one came? Because Sonari, your second favorite guest.
Second, yes.
Since he also sometimes is edited by Sarah, or was before she left NPR, and he sent her a mixtape. And she listened to the mixtape. I think she was like, what should I be listening to? He sends her a mixtape. And then she calls me, and she's like, what is up with all of these guys singing like ladies? And by the way, someone else did a piece about that very recently. Washington Post. They just did it. Last week, Chris Richards from Washington Post did a piece about falsettos, which is a very different piece than mine, and a really good one. I learned a lot from it. I was like, oh, yeah, should have thought about this. What about that?
Do you ever revisit pieces? Do you do a part two?
Yes, I have. I was recently asked to revisit a piece, but not quite in the way you mean, I think. But we're doing an end-of-the-year series right now where we were asked to sort of go back to pieces we did and think of, like, meaningful characters that are going to be important next year. So I'm actually doing one about Harriet Tubman.
Yeah.
And I'm revisiting a piece I did about the show Underground, which is a criminally underwatched show that is terrifically good.
I've never heard of it.
And right? No one has heard of it. It's so good. It's about the Underground Railroad. And this is on the one hand, the genius thing about it and also the problem with it. The people who created it and who do it, it's a white guy and a black woman. And they both got they met doing the show Heroes. And they're both giant comic book fans and action adventure fans. And they were like, this is one of the most thrilling, interesting episodes in all of American history, in all of history. So we're going to do this, like, thrilling comic book action adventure TV show about the Underground Railroad. And it's not going to be serious, and it's not going to be, I mean, it is serious. Of course it's serious. You know, it's about slavery. It's super serious.
Right.
But, you know, but they wanted to really capture they wanted to make it 24. You know, they wanted to make it like this unbelievable, nail-biting drama that is not just like, that's not 12 Years a Slave, where you're just like, oh,
right.
I'm just dreading the whipping scene, or it's not Beloved, where you're dreading the, you know, drowning the baby scene. And then what do they do in the first episode? They drown a baby, and there's a whipping scene.
Oh, gosh.
And then after that, it becomes exactly what they describe. It becomes like this nail-biting, brightly colored, like super engrossing, history is just like this unbelievable thing that feels incredibly very much of the moment. Like, I just read Colson Whitehead's Underground Railroad book, and my piece was partly just about, like, how now, you know, the Underground Railroad is finding its place in popular culture. It's such a good, good series. And if you watch the very first episode, you're going to be like, oh, my God, this is so depressing. And it is actually filled with just, like, these twists and these double crosses and these, like, incredibly heroic people and these you know, this, the kind of, like, a radical scheming and bargains that are struck. And it's so good. You will love it.
I'm totally checking this out. We just finished. I know this will be an awkward transition from this show to the Underground, but we finished Gilmore Girls today, so we're all primed for a new show, and I think that'll be a really nice transition.
Oh, I love Gilmore Girls. Can I just tell you, Ken, is the warm blanket that I've wrapped myself in for the past, like, 6 months. It's so awesome.
Yeah. And so you're all caught up? You've watched the four latest movies?
No. Oh. I'm still catching up, because there's a lot of episodes. And much like donuts, you know, you can kind of, like, eat your way through half a box, and then you need to take a little break. And you're like, okay, I'm good. And then, like, 2 hours later, like, you know what would be really good would be another episode of Gilmore Girls or another donut. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah. It's when you start singing the theme song in the supermarket, that's when you know you've crossed to the bad place. Just put that out there.
Wait, I want to hear your rendition.
Oh, I can't wait to do that for you off the air. So another story that you did.
Okay.
By the way, it seems like the least gay story, but you surely know that the gays love Renee Montaigne.
Everyone loves Renee Montaigne.
And so you did a really lovely piece on Renee Montaigne stepping down as the host of Morning Edition, which I just thought was
awesome.
She's so awesome, but you handled it. Not that you can't handle Renee without dignity, but it was just I felt okay about her leaving after that piece. Not great about it, but okay with it.
Yeah, well, then I clearly did my job. I think that's exactly what I was intended to do. I was sad that she stepped down, but I'm also really glad, you know, I'm really glad that she's still going to be contributing pieces to the air. I will tell you, when I first started, she was just so kind to me. She's a terrific human being. She's really, really, really good. And, there were a few moments early in my career where I was just, like, super nervous, and she was just reassuring and at the same time, like, not, like, at the same time, just like, look, kid, this is how you do it. And we're in this together, and it's going to be okay. She's so good.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, can we talk about another personality who I know that you had great, great respect for? Talk to our listeners about Gwen Ifill. You covered her passing in such a beautiful way.
Oh, thank you. That sucked. I just knew Gwen Ifill a little bit.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. And, but certainly I think, I can't imagine the person who didn't run across Gwen Ifill and wasn't just captivated and blown away by her intellect and her charisma and her she was unbelievably down to earth. You know, she's just one of those people where when you met her, she made you feel comfortable. And I was, of course, completely intimidated to meet her. She was, and it feels weird to talk about her in the past tense. She's a really, really amazing person. And we got a call at 2:00 saying that it seemed that Gwen Ifill might have passed away. And even the person who told me was like, this can't be true. You know, she was only 61. We haven't heard anything. But, you know, maybe you should just start working on something just in case. And then we got confirmation pretty soon after that she had indeed died of cancer, which she really hadn't been very, it wasn't just that she wasn't public about it. It was that it happened kind of quickly.
Yeah.
She was diagnosed and then it got quite severe, I think, quite fast. And so I ended up having to turn that obituary for someone who I mean, you know, I do a lot of obituaries for really amazing people. But when it's someone like Gwen Ifill, she was just such an extraordinary light in the world in which I work. And to have to put together this obituary in like what ended up being like an hour and a half was I wish I could have worked on it for months.
Well,
I wish I could have done so much more.
You said this, Gwen Ifill could turn arguments into discussions. She listened and she made sure her audience was informed about the facts. She moderated all of us who watched her. It's like, oh gosh, that's right. That's what we're shooting for, isn't it?
Yeah.
Inspiring stuff, and a talent, an unbelievable talent, and an unbelievable talent on your end to capture in so few words who she was and what she did for us. So,
you know, this was such a terrible year for. I mean, it's never a good year.
Right.
Wonderful people die every year, but Jesus, this year.
This was a rough year.
God.
It was a rough year.
I mean, it was like we started with Prince and we ended with Glenn Ifill.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
This
is going to be a year that we'll look back on and say, where were you during these times in this year? And we at least know it during Christmas time where the two of us were and we spent some time together. So,
well, you know, I remember going and hearing the author Juno Diaz talk a few, like during, like in the aftermath of September 11th, and it was before he wrote his Pulitzer Prize winning book, The Magical Terrible Life of Oscar Wilde. I've just completely mangled the title, but it was something like that. And he was like, every single person should be keeping a diary right now.
Yeah.
Because we are living in extraordinary times.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know about you, but when I was like, I remember like being in high school in the 80s, and I remember saying to my mother, you know, my grandmother remembers when electricity became commonplace. She was born before women had the right to vote. She saw, as my mother did, as did yours, saw man land on the moon. You know, there. I am never going to experience anything in my lifetime that is as dramatic as what my grandmother has experienced, World War II, you know, all of this stuff. And look at us now.
Yeah. Yes, we have different stories, apparently, to tell now.
They're so much better.
Yes, that was so convincing.
I can't wait to tell my mutant grandchildren about what things were like in 1996.
These are the times when we're kind of just hoping, well, maybe the Ayatollah was Santa Claus.
Exactly.
That's like our best case scenario right now. So that's what we're shooting for. Oh, good stuff. Well, what are you looking forward to? What stories are coming up for you that I know you can't usually tell us a lot about what's coming up for you, but any broad strokes of themes we should be looking for?
Yes, I have such a good story to tell all of your listeners about because they are going to love this. So they may not be into web comics. I am not a big, I mean, I like comics as much as the next person. You know, I loved Mouse. You know, the comics are good. But I, you know, I'm not a devoted follower of them. But my same old editor, Sarah Saracen, told me about this comic called Check, Please.
Huh.
And this is a comic about a gay college hockey star who likes also to bake pies. And this comic is the absolute best. And it's written by a woman who is, I don't know if she's African-American or the daughter of African immigrants. I don't know enough yet about her backstory. She cannot play hockey. I don't know how she found what her connection is to this world. And, of course, like the world of fandom, you know, is filled with people who are telling, you know, often very homoerotic stories about people. She started doing this comic. She's unbelievably brilliant. She's a graduate student. She went to Yale as an undergraduate. She now is a graduate student at the Savannah College of Art and Design. Check, Please, the comic that your listeners are going to so enjoy and that I am so grateful that I learned about. It's so good.
I am checking that out.
I am doing a piece about it right now.
I love it. I love it. Well, we have to end as we always end with a little learning annex.
What? We have to end?
I've never done an interview that we have to spread over 2 weeks. So unless we keep going, that would be amazing. We have to do a little learning annex with Netta Ulaby for all of our aspiring broadcasters out there. Where do you tell people to get started to come up with stories? You mentioned at the start of this interview, they shouldn't just have one idea. So how do they generate different ideas to put together a story?
All I can say is that what I did was that I was a hungry, hungry media consumer when I started off, and I didn't consider myself a journalist. I was just someone who really loved reading about things, you know, in newspapers and magazines, and I basically started at the absolute bottom. I picked the media outlets that I enjoyed and yet seemed most desperate, and I approached them with pitches, and that worked for me.
Okay. That's what we got to do. That's what we got to do. Listeners, this is what I need you to do. Stroll on over to npr.org. You can search for Netta Olby. We will provide a link directly to all of her content. I'm going to tell you a secret that I have never told anyone. This is episode 382. I've never told a guest this before. And it's a little behind-the-scenes secret of this show is so gay. The shorter the praise for my guest actually means I respect them so much more. So yes, I can opine about you forever, but if I can do it in just a few words, that actually means I barely can come up with how strongly I feel about the impact that you're having. And I will tell you this, Netta, what it is that you do is that you make us pause. And in this world where we are just hurtling forward without pausing, that is such a talent of yours, and I am so supremely grateful to it. You have made me pause so many different times to just say, oh, wait a second, I actually need to slow down for a second and think about this art that I'm consuming, what it is that I'm seeing around me, and it really is a beautiful thing, Netta.
Oh, Ken. Well, pause for station identification. With that joke about we pause. There's so many jokes I could start making right now that we pause, but we're not going to do it.
Okay. Again, npr.org, search for Netta Olby. Netta, until next Christmas.
All right. I'll look forward to it.
I just love that Netta Olby. It's one of the great privileges of doing this show is that I get to talk to these folks over and over again. We've been on the air for 8 years now. This was Netta's 7th time on the show. She was first on the show in December of 2008. And so I get to develop these relationships and continue conversations and deepen the dialogue. And it's such an absolute privilege. It's such an absolute honor. And just to behold her craft and the way she approaches this work, just inspiring stuff. Netta Olby, NPR Arts and Entertainment reporter. Amazing work. Amazing work. One of the downsides in doing this show is that no matter when I record, news will break right after I finish editing. And so there's no way, because I don't do a live show, there's no way to be totally up to date. And some of you listen to the show about a week after I record, and there's not a lot I can do about that because we're on so many different stations that air our show at so many different times. So this is one of those stories that by the time you listen to this episode, I suspect this story will be more developed, but as NPR is reporting right now, the fate of North Carolina's HB2 law is unclear. A vote is expected this week. It's actually expected the day that we're recording here. The North Carolina legislature began a special session this Wednesday morning to vote on the repeal of a controversial state law, but it's unclear which way the vote will go. The vote was part of a deal between state lawmakers and Charlotte officials, but some Republican state leaders are furious about about the way that they say Charlotte handled its side of the agreement. Charlotte officials, meanwhile, are denying allegations that they misrepresented their actions. The state law in question is, of course, HB 2, also called the bathroom bill, because, among other things, this is not the only thing that it does. This is among other things. It does require trans people to use bathrooms that match the sex on their birth certificate. It was passed in March in direct response to an expansion of a local anti-discrimination measure in Charlotte the previous month. Republican state lawmakers and Democratic leaders in Charlotte had apparently struck a deal under which the city would repeal the local ordinance, and in return, state lawmakers would repeal HB 2. But now everyone's saying that everyone else is reneging on the deal, so we'll see what happens there. I was just reflecting as I was putting these stories together. I can't think of how many times we talked about North Carolina in the previous 7 years of this show. Before this all came down in March, I don't think we were talking about North Carolina all that much. Maybe an occasional story, maybe one a year. Whereas now, every single week this year, I feel like we are talking about North Carolina, and yeah, it's not good. As so many news outlets have reported, North Carolina has lost billions of dollars, billions of tourism dollars. Their reputation has been so tarnished, and we know, especially as a show that broadcasts in North Carolina, and we know that you guys are listening to us in Asheville and surrounding communities there, we know that there are incredible folks doing incredible work to advance LGBTQ equality in the great state of North Carolina. But unfortunately, your lawmakers have created a situation where, yes, the reputation of North Carolina very much has been tarnished. So here's hoping we're done with HB 2. We're certainly done with the governor, though, as we said last week, it looks like he might have a slot in the Trump administration. We will see. Well, a slew of stories this week that in some way connected to Orlando and the Pulse massacre this past summer. The editor of Orlando's only LGBT newspaper has opened up about the community struggling to come to terms with the aftermath of the Pulse shooting. 50 people were killed. Not that I need to remind you, but we have to talk about things like this. 50 people were murdered during the horrific attack in June. Gosh, it seems like so long ago. June was not that long ago. It was the largest mass shooting in U.S. history. The majority of victims were LGBT people of color. Speaking to NPR's All Things Considered, the editor of Orlando's LGBT newspaper, Watermark, Billy Maines, opened up about the fear that continues to exist locally following the attack. He said this, quote, "We're a lot more careful about ourselves and how we present at this point, which I don't think is a great thing. Nobody wants to seem too gay, do they? We've had developments since the Pulse shooting that have indicated we may not be in the best graces of the general public." Asked to clarify, he went on to say this, quote, "I'm referring to the November 8th election. There's been so much sort of collective good that's going on, and I'm not trying to downplay that, but there is so much licensed hate right now, and I'm hearing it more than I've ever heard it in my life." That's down there in Orlando. But it goes on. It goes on. More stories connected to Orlando. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations has made a passionate plea for LGBT rights to be protected, asking those against an LGBT expert why they don't want to prevent attacks like the Pulse nightclub. Samantha Power made the call this week, referring back to the Pulse nightclub massacre. The ambassador's words came as attempts to remove the independent expert on sexual orientation and gender identity were narrowly avoided. Power said this, quote, "The proponents of the amendment argue in their explanatory note that their reason for seeking a delay was that there is no international agreement on the definition of the concept of sexual orientation and gender identity. That is patently false. The issue of violence or discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity is well established and well understood. In reality, this amendment has little to do with questions around the definition of sexual orientation and gender identity. Instead, this amendment is rooted in a real disagreement over whether people of a certain sexual orientation and gender identity are, in fact, entitled to equal rights, and it is being driven by a group of UN member states that believe it is acceptable to treat people differently because of who or what they are." She later on said this, quote, "Tell me, why would any member state stand in the way of trying to prevent violence like the attack at that Orlando nightclub?" So that's happening in the UN, and still more stories connected to Orlando. A powerful artwork featuring Harry Potter characters will appear in a comic book to raise funds for Orlando Pulse victims after J.K. Rowling gave her blessing. The artwork was created by celebrated comic book artist Jim Lee, and the Potter author gave her blessing for it to appear in the Love is Love anthology comic book. It is one of 100 works that will be printed in the anthology, all of which are dedicated to the memory of the Orlando victims. One of the people murdered in that horrific attack was Luis S. Vielma, who worked at Harry Potter World at Universal Studios, where a poignant wand-raised vigil took place following the horrific attack. Lee's powerful image evokes the scene featuring Harry Potter, Hermione Granger, Ron Weasley, and Albus Dumbledore conjuring a combined rainbow Patronus while bearing a poignant quote from Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. The quote is one of the endless wise lines uttered by gay Hogwarts headmaster Albus Dumbledore, quote, "Differences of habit and language are nothing at all if our aims are identical and our hearts are open." Again, differences of habit and language are nothing at all if our aims are identical and our hearts are open. J.K. Rowling explained this, quote, "The comic industry comes together in honor of those killed in Orlando. Co-published by two of the premier publishers in comics, DC and IDW, this oversized comic contains moving and heartfelt material from some of the greatest talent in comics, mourning the victims, supporting the survivors, celebrating the LGBTQ community, and examining love in today's world. All material has been kindly donated by the writers, artists, and editors, with all proceeds going to victims, survivors, and their families. Be a part of Historic Comics event. It doesn't matter who you love. All that matters is that you love." So you can find that online. Again, that quote, "Differences of habit and language are nothing at all, if our aims are identical and our hearts are open." Incredible stuff. Tons more comic book news. Recently, Marvel Comics revealed that long-standing bit character D-Man was a gay man. Today, DC Comics has done something similar with the Nightwing character Stallion, who first appeared in 1997 in Nightwing number 17, and who died with much of the rest of the town Bloodhaven in Infinite Crisis. Well, that's been all done away with, apparently. He's back. The ex-Dallas Cowboys football player turned supervillain who dresses up in leather and carries a Stetson, turns out he's gay. That makes a difference. People always write in and say, "I don't understand why you cover these random comic book stories," because this reaches a huge segment of our population. And I know me. Look, let's just talk about me. I will speak from the eye. As someone who grew up within the pages of the X-Men, I really grew up within the pages of the X-Men. All of my comic books now sit behind me, right where I sit in my recording studio at home. Last time I was at my parents' house in New Jersey, they said, "We need you to take your comic books back to Cleveland with you." So they're sitting right behind me. And holy cow, there are a lot of them. I knew that there were a lot. I didn't know there were quite this many. But I grew up in the pages of comic books. And I grew up specifically within the X-Men, where they valued difference, where it was all about people who were being shunned by society for being different. And had there been a gay comic book character then, that would have made a huge difference to me. To see our lives represented in the various media, and for me, my media was comic books, it really does make a difference. So, Stallion, a proud gay man in DC Comics, Nightwing. There you go. And another important representation story, the first LGBT character has been revealed in Overwatch. After the game's makers said earlier this year that there are multiple such characters in the game, in an official comic released ahead of Christmas, the makers of Overwatch, a big game, said earlier this year that there were several LGBT characters, stopping short of revealing which characters were LGBT. The lead writer for the game, Michael Chu, back in November confirmed that in an upcoming update, characters will be revealed as LGBT, and now the comic reveals that Tracer is the first LGBT character. I don't know who Tracer is. I don't play this game. But in the comic, Tracer is shown in her London home trying to choose a gift for her partner. I love that. She's very generous, that Tracer. Later in the comic, her relationship with Emily is revealed. So that's also really important to see ourselves represented, not just in comic books, but also in games. Chu said to fans in a Q&A session earlier this year, quote, "It's very important for us to have diversity and inclusiveness of all types, and that includes LGBT characters. There are definitely LGBT heroes in Overwatch. That's multiple heroes. We want the stories about characters' relationships, not just romantic, but familial relationships and stuff like that, to come out in the course of stories that we feel really do them justice. It's something that absolutely is important to us." So there you go, Tracer in the game Overwatch. Really important representation there. Turning to religion, a Catholic priest has argued in the Vatican newspaper. I didn't even know the Vatican had a newspaper, although I guess it's a city, so yeah, they have a newspaper. But a Catholic priest has argued in the Vatican newspaper that technically gay priests are not banned. He says they're not banned. Father Louis Camelli, a priest for the Chicago Archdiocese, wrote in this newspaper that I can't pronounce because it's in Italian and I will butcher it, but it is the official Vatican newspaper. He wrote that the church, quote, cannot admit to the seminary or to holy orders those who practice homosexuality, present deep-seated homosexual tendencies, or support the so-called gay culture. The priest argued that a new document published by a Vatican office earlier this month does not amount to a blanket prohibition of admission to the seminary or holy orders. The document, The Gift of the Priestly Vocation, appeared to reiterate a 2005 policy which barred gay men from becoming priests as well as sexually active men. Well, Father Camelli, who has written extensively on the Church's teachings on homosexuality, and who has advised at least two cardinals on theological issues, published his analysis on December 18th. In the column, he wrote this, quote, "A person who supports the gay culture, understood as an environment and a movement that advocates moral stances at variance with church teaching, cannot at the same time be entrusted with teaching and leading the community of faith." But he added a further clause in the document which bans men with deep-seated homosexual tendencies. He said that is less clear. A lot of drama there in the Catholic Church. We'll see if they change their doctrine. I probably wouldn't hold my breath on that one. A legal victory. A transgender man in New York is celebrating a victory after being allowed to legally change his name. Ben Stanford had previously been denied the name change petition after a lower court said he declined to provide medical evidence of his transition. Stanford's attorney Lori Stika Bloom from Nixon Peabody, working on behalf of the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund, argued that nobody should be forced to provide medical evidence, especially since other name change petitions do not require such evidence. Stanford said he was relieved to have been granted the legal name change by the state's appeal court. He said this, quote, "I have worked hard to be who I am and live my life authentically. Having a name that did not match my identity caused me great difficulty in my daily life, particularly when forced to present inaccurate identification. Thankfully, I finally have a name that accurately reflects my true self. I am grateful to everyone involved for helping me through this ordeal. I can now move forward with my life as myself." See, these legal victories will absolutely make a difference as we move forward, folks. They will absolutely make a difference. People can live more authentically. They can live more open. That will help mental health. That will help physical health. It will help our entire community. And I would argue it would help our whole society. And on a grandiose comment like that, that's where I end this week's episode. Our thanks, of course, to Netta Ulaby. Can't wait to have her back next Christmas. And of course, our thanks to you all for listening. Get out there. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters, for all of our allies out there. And while you're out there making a difference, while you're out there using your voice, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?